Hello and welcome to a special episode of Dysphagia Matters. My name is Jule.
And I'm Julia.
This time we're recording from the Congress of the European Society of Swallowing Disorders in Leuven in Belgium. It is the first time that we are attending this Congress in person and we are excited to meet so many different researchers and clinicians. We are sitting here together with two amazing researchers who agreed to join us to discuss a clinical case scenario. You might remember Dr. Ulrike Frank. She was our guest in episode 2 about coordination of respiration and swallowing. Welcome, Ulrike. For anyone who has not listened to episode 2 yet, would you mind quickly introducing yourself?
Oh, yes. Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm Ulrike Frank. I'm a speech-language therapist and dysphagia researcher, and I work for the University of Potsdam in Germany, and we have a lab there, and we do research and investigate different diagnostic and therapeutic methods to rehabilitate patients with dysphagia with a focus on respiratory function and breathing swallowing coordination and biofeedback methods. So thank you for having me here.
Thanks for taking the time. And a big welcome and thank you also to our second guest, Dr. James Curtis. We are very happy to have you on this episode. Would you mind introducing yourself as well?
Yes, thank you. So my name is James Curtis. I'm a speech pathologist. I've been practicing for about 10 years. I recently completed my PhD and postdoctoral work at the Laboratory for the Study of Upper Airway Dysfunction at Columbia University with Dr. Michelle Troche as my mentor. And I am a new assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medicine, where I'll be doing research 4 days a week and clinical work 1 day a week. So,
yes. Sounds great.
Yes. Congratulations. Thank you.
Okay, a quick explanation before we start. For today's episode, we have prepared a clinical case, which is based on a case scenario described in a book by Katrin Eibe. You can find the link in the show notes. Julia will present the case history of our patient Tom, and we are already excited to follow the decision-making process of our two dysphagia experts in the clinical management of Tom.
Tom was brought into the emergency department. His housekeeper found him lying on his stomach on the kitchen floor, and it's suspected that he's been there for 4 days. He has massive swelling and hematoma on his left eye, left cheekbone, and left forearm. He was awake, responsive, and oriented to the person, but could not remember falling, so he only remembers being dizzy and being too weak to stand up or turn around. So the 84-year-old patient has a lying trauma with multiple pressure necrosis after fall of unclear cause. But there is a known Parkinson's disease and arterial hypertension. Regarding his social history, Tom lives alone and maintains his fitness with half an hour of exercise every day. He was a lawyer and his sister is his next of kin. According to his sister, eating and drinking is very important to Tom. So, James, do you have any thoughts on this so far?
A few different thoughts. I mean, what comes to mind already is thinking about risk factors for dysphagia, just at baseline, his age, his sex, his diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, all already putting him at risk for dysphagia. And so currently I'm thinking about the implications with that, and all we're trying to separate any sort of baseline dysphagia with acute events. So yeah, that's my current line of thinking is.
Great. What about you, Ulrike?
Oh, well, yes. I was wondering what his general medical condition is, because, well, there must be a reason that he fell down, and I suspect that, well, his general medical condition is not very well, so you can ask, why is that the case? So maybe he's in a state of malnutrition and very weak. Maybe we get to know more about his disease now. So, I don't want to speculate too much, but that's what I wonder about.
I will tell you some more information about the course of his disease after admission. So, Thomas initially admitted to the general ward, but within the next 2 days, he develops high fever, delirium, and massive secretions, in addition to hypotension and bradycardia at night. So, he is transferred to the intensive care unit. He also develops an acute hypercapnic respiratory insufficiency. It is suspected that Tom has severe pneumonia due to continuous aspiration of secretion. and therefore he's being intubated. After 4 days, Tom can be extubated. He continues to present with increased bronchial secretions, shows high inflammation blood values, and remains nil per mouth due to severe dysphagia and also has a nasogastric tube in situ. This also makes it difficult to administer the Parkinson's medication, whereupon Tom develops a strong rigor. At the same time, he is additionally weakened due to exocosis and cachexia with suspected malnutrition. Over the next 8 days, Tom stabilizes increasingly but continues to show severe dysphagia and rigor. 2 weeks after admission, Tom can be admitted to the general geriatric ward. Before we start discussing possible diagnostic and treatment options, we would like to clarify one possibly relevant term. So, Ulrike, Tom developed an acute hypercapnic respiratory insufficiency. Would you mind explaining what this means and how this can impact swallowing?
Yes, sure. I can try to explain that. Well, as you know, respiration is about gas exchange. So that's the reason why we inhale and exhale, because we want to get oxygen into our blood. That's what we do when we inhale. We provide oxygen, and during exhalation, we want to eliminate carbon dioxide. And when an individual is not able to eliminate that carbon dioxide, it gets stuck in the blood, so it accumulates in the blood, and that's what we call hypercapnia. And, reasons for this hypercapnia can be a motor problem, so like in people with ALS, so that you just can't have enough effort or breathing effort or muscular effort to eliminate that carbon dioxide, or it can be a problem of the bronchoalveolar system, like in people with COPD, for example. Well, we don't exactly know why that is the case in Tom, but I would suspect that it's really due to his unstable medical condition and to his pneumonia, that he is not able to eliminate this carbon dioxide. This impacts swallowing because the body tries to compensate for such a situation. So the body has a great interest in getting rid of that carbon dioxide. And in order to do that, there are several compensatory mechanisms. And one is that the respiratory rates are increasing. So these persons, they develop a kind of rapid shallow breathing pattern. And that can be really have negative effects, for example, on breathing swallowing coordination. So it puts persons at an increased risk of aspiration, and, well, it limits the effectiveness of coughing. So this is basically the relationship between the state and swallowing function.
Additionally to all the other underlying causes that he already has.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Great. So, Ulrike, as a speech and language therapist, you're asked to assess Tom. You meet him lying in bed on his side. He is too weak for sitting upright, but awake, and he returns your greeting. You already notice a gurgling voice, and you recognize excessive saliva in his mouth and also drooling of saliva. Tom's speech is very slurred, and he is hardly intelligible. The nurse tells you that he has been coughing mildly for hours, but he cannot really mobilize the secretion sufficiently to expectorate or swallow it. So we would like to know, what would you do next now?
Well, from all what we have learned now, I expect that he won't be able to cooperate for a long time. So I would do steps in clinical swallowing examination, obviously, but I would reduce that to the most important things at that time, because I would expect that he can't cooperate for half an hour or, well. So I would do pick just some components that are most interesting for me, and one of that components would be that I would assess his communicative abilities and particularly his language comprehension, so that I know how good I can interact with him on a verbal, in a verbal way. And also I would assess cough strength and his ability to clear his secretions on his own. Because as you said, we have a gurgly voice, so this is an indicator for aspiration, of course. He has a drooling of the saliva, so I want to know whether he is able to just eliminate that secretions or that saliva from the larynx. Well, also in order to assess how good he will be able to eat or drink or be orally fed. And also, first step I would do is to assess his general respiratory function. So to just assess respiratory rates, to have an indication where I see respiratory activity, which of his respiratory muscles are functioning well. Because I think first steps for me in the clinical procedure would be to help him on his respiratory side. So to improve respiration and, well, I can get many information about that respiratory function when I just watch where he's good, so where he's working, where I can see the respiratory work and where I have to help him. Yeah, that's actually some things I would pick first. Maybe pick more if he's more cooperative, but next thing I would do is definitely to have an instrumental assessment of Tom, because I would really be curious why he's aspirating so much. Because I think this is something, when you present that case to me, it's not clear why he is so... Yeah, he seems to have a very severe dysphagic problem, and, well, it seems to have deteriorated rapidly. So I would like to know why that is the case, because he has a slowly progressing disease,
yeah,
as far as I understood.
Is there anything you would like to add?
No, I mean, I think that in terms of what you'd be evaluating, I'm completely on board. It sounds like there's a lot of respiratory morbidities going on with this gentleman at the time. And that sounds great. Yeah.
Good. And would you already do the instrumental assessment at this point, even though he's still lying in bed and he cannot sit up right?
Yeah, I think it probably depends on the type of instrumental assessment as well. So, you know, certainly his cognitive state, if he's staying, you know, aware and he's got the attention and the ability to kind of participate in the evaluation. Certainly, I think if you're doing something like a flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, that's something that we could pull bedside, probably also depending on what it is that we're specifically wanting to look at. But it would seem, based off of the information we've been provided so far, he would be a great candidate for an instrumental assessment if it's accessible.
Yeah, and I think it depends on what you expect from that instrumental assessment. I would definitely do no bolus trials, so I think it makes no sense to have a real functional endoscopic in terms of, well, I really want to assess the swallowing function comprehensively, but to have a first impression of what is going on there and how the status of the larynx is and what kind of secretions and the amount of secretions I see there, I would definitely do it as long as I have the impression that he tolerates that and it's not over-exaggerating that first diagnostic step.
Yeah, no, I mean, to add to that, it's asking kind of what is the instrumental assessment adding and how is it going to be affecting management? He has an NG tube. Is he completely reliant on the NG tube at this point? So maybe there's considerations of, you know, can we begin PO trials or not?
So I'm going to give you some more information because you're at a great point there. Okay. So you realize that he cannot swallow on command. And like you said, you would test his cough strength. If you asked him to produce a strong cough, he can only manage to slightly clear his throat. So is that adding anything or still the same?
I think maybe it would depend a little bit more on the clinical evaluation as well. So when I hear that patient can't swallow on command, I definitely kind of want to know why. He's able to do other things on command, correct? And it sounds like he's got probably excessive saliva rather than something like a dry mouth that would be prohibiting him from doing a swallow on command. So I don't know. I'd want to test a couple of things at bedside to see, can we even do any boluses if that's, you know, the reason for the instrumental assessment.
Anything specific that you would test?
I would just try a super small sip of water or something to see if it is bolus related and motor control related. So is there something with the stimulus that might elicit swallowing of food or liquid? But I've only met one person who hasn't been able to swallow on command. So so that's my experience. I'm not sure yours.
Well, given that new information, I would even more have a fees on him because, well, I wonder why that
that patient has been ventilated invasively in the first place. Because, well, as I see that case, he's able to communicate, so he can't be that reduced in his vigilance. So normally when somebody has a pneumonia, you wouldn't just right intubate, but would try non-invasive ventilation. But there might be reasons why he had been directly intubated. I don't know. But as he was intubated, and for quite a long time, when I got that right, I think that were about 96 hours or what? Well, that's just quite a long time for an intubation, and given that you tell me that while his cough is not effective, I know that his general condition is not effective, he seems to be weak because he is hypercapnic, I would wonder how the laryngeal system is and the situation is. Maybe he has some kind of post-extubation damage or intubation damage, so that might be an explanation for his weak cough and also for his voice problems and articulation problems. So I think this is even more a reason to directly scope. Just have an impression, because you want to know whether you can feed him to improve him. Yeah,
I think another potential added benefit of the fees is the history of the secretions that you mentioned, and the suspicion that he developed the pneumonia because of continuous aspiration on the secretions. Maybe this is way off in left field, but the time that I worked with someone who couldn't initiate a swallow was someone with a brainstem stroke, and I do wonder if the fall somehow impacted brain injury in the level of the brainstem somewhere. I'm sure that probably would have been looked at in patient, but had it not, then that might be something for fluoro to look at, things like UES opening, which we obviously can't see with fees. So I could see kind of going either way in terms of instrumentation if we are thinking instrumentation is going to be impacting our management plan.
That's a really good point. That might be also the cause for his falling and loss of consciousness. Yeah. And so did I get you right that you would both go for a FEES and not a video fluoroscopy at this point? Or
that might be my first step. And then if I feel like I still need a fluoro, I've worked at places where I've had the opportunity to do both, and I think if both will affect your management, then I think I'd probably start with the fees, though, because of the secretions mainly, and trying to figure out why he's not able to initiate a swallow. But
other clinicians might have just done an oral motor exam or clinical swallow evaluation, and then based on this decided that due to he's still lying in bed and he's not able to sit in a chair, for example, for long enough, that this wouldn't be the point where you would do an instrumental assessment, because you wouldn't really try to oralize him at this stage, just because he can't sit, and which would mean he can't eat and drink. What do you think about this?
So I think the reason to do an instrumental with him would, from my point of view, would not be, can I feed him in the first place? But I would really like to know about the situation that brought him to that situation. So I would like to know what's the problem. So why is he in such a state? And is there really a manifest dysphagia problem here? Or do we have an aspiration problem here? Or is it something else that brought him into that condition? And what one piece in the puzzle is to find out whether the patient aspirates or not. And I would like to know what is it about all these secretions over there? And only in the second, as a second thought, I would have the question, can I feed him orally? Because he seems in such a bad situation, and he has a nasogastric tube, so he can be fed by the tube, and I can really take it slow, giving him oral feeding, and well, according to his progression and his recovery from pneumonia and recovery from that intubation. So he might just need some days.
Yeah, I was going to kind of add to that. I could see total rationale for being like, we don't need an instrumental assessment at this point. We're seeing a very kind of drastic change in his status. Let's wait a couple of days until he is more stable, or until we think it's going to adjust the, starting to recommend diets and whatnot, because I think at that point, that might be when it is actually going to start affecting my management, unless you are thinking about like rehabilitative exercises at that point, which I'm not sure you'd be doing with this gentleman, but maybe you are. So I could see a rationale for being like, this is not an appropriate time. Let me come back in 2 to 3 days, see where he's at, and then kind of figure out an assessment from there. So I don't think that there's necessarily like a exact kind of right or wrong. I could see kind of rationales for both.
I agree. Totally. Yes.
Okay, great. And would you do treatment in between, or due to him?
Depends on what you mean with treatment.
Yeah, all types, like any intervention that could be compensatory, some type of stimulation, or I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that.
So he's in the acute phase right now.
Yeah.
Still, okay, yeah.
But he's not on the ICU anymore.
Not in the ICU, yeah. Okay.
I would not go away and say, okay, see you in 3 days. Definitely not. I would really like to find out more about his swallowing function before I begin real with oral nutrition. But I think there is no point in keeping him from doing therapy. Yes, of course, and maybe because just starting with oral motor exercises in a very, very, very low level way, and of course helping him with his secretions and helping him to get rid of his secretions independently. And that can be respiratory techniques, that can be laryngeal clearing techniques, and I think there's no point in keeping him from that. You can, of course, in the range of his abilities, you can do that because, as you said, James, you have to think about the further rehabilitation and about the further rehabilitation steps. And, of course, you can begin as much as he can cooperate with all these steps. And if it's only 5 minutes, it's okay. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. So do you want to know more about the fees?
Yes.
Okay.
We're coming to the point.
Finally, fees results.
Hard work. We don't give information out that easily. Sorry, you gotta do hard work for that.
Okay, and it's unfortunately not the fees results that you wanted for your early fees, but in this case, the fees was conducted later after a clinical bedside evaluation and after they tried several swallows of water. So after swallowing 3 teaspoons of water, Tom produced a mild cough per swallow after each teaspoon.
This is the clinical evaluation, or is this during the fees?
The clinical, the clinical first. So I'm talking to you as the therapist or the clinicians. You tried ITSE level 4, so purite consistencies, and after 3 spoons, Tom shows the delayed cough post-swallow. So then the fees was conducted afterwards. There you observed severe aspiration of saliva of ITSE level 4 and ITSE level 0 with inconsistent cough response. So it would be a 7 or 8 on the penetration aspiration scale. You also observed premature spillage and residues of all tested consistencies in both molecular and piriform sinuses. So now to both of you, what could be possible explanations for this?
Well, I think the secretions make sense if he's not swallowing at all. I'm not sure if we saw any sort of spontaneous swallows during the actual fees, or if it's just swallows on command that he's not able to do. But I think if there's a reduced swallow frequency and deconditioned state, which he is certainly likely still in, clearance of those secretions is going to be certainly reduced. So I think the aspiration of the secretions makes sense. In terms of aspiration in general, I think it is not completely surprising. I think the why is the thing that we want to ultimately get to, that will require further investigation. And the premature spillage, that's always an interesting finding that is pretty variable even in healthy adults. And so I'm not putting too many eggs in that basket. I think it's encouraging at the very least that we are seeing him able to swallow. Presumably he was swallowing and then there was aspiration occurring as a result and it was just not an absent swallow. And it's also encouraging that there is a cough that's present, albeit inconsistent. I'd be curious if it's inconsistent because he's not coughing when it's small amounts versus large amounts. And so that's something that we see even in healthy adults. Understanding kind of his sensory integrity and our ability to kind of trust when he's feeling the need to cough versus not. But the findings make sense and doesn't sound like it's surprising if we just saw him clinically being someone at relatively high risk. That's my thought. I don't know.
That's a really great point. So it might be that he's rather coughing on the greater volumes because he does have sensory deficits.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Yeah. Well done.
And I should mention that it's not just necessarily the bolus volume. This is actually some research that I presented on a couple years ago and have submitted for publication. But it really seems to be more about the amount that's actually aspirated and not like the bolus volume that was given. So just for clarity's sake, when I was mentioning the amount, I'm talking about the amount that literally we were seeing subglottically and not like it was a 20 ml trial that was given. Okay. So just for clarity.
Would you like anything to add?
Well, I think that was very comprehensive. So, well, he might be kind of post-exacerbation dysphagia still, even after 8 days. That would be possible. So if you ask about reasons, that might be one reason. Because much aspiration on many consistencies, even on saliva, that he shows, so I wouldn't be surprised that maybe you find some laryngeal evidence for edema or traumata or whatever, maybe being one piece on the puzzle.
Maybe it's even it's also difficult to determine where the sensory deficits come from. Was it the intubation, extubation, or has maybe already been existing beforehand from the Parkinson's? Or how do you try to find out where what comes from?
Well, I think it's not always really, really necessary to know, oh, this comes from that. It's very likely that part of that sensory deficit comes from the disease. It's very likely it comes, well, it might be kind of, well, post-intensive care syndrome that contributes to that. I think you have to ask yourself, does it affect your management? Mm-hmm. Or is your management the same?
Yeah, I think at this point, like, in his care, it would be probably pretty impossible to know. I think the most we could do is, depending on his cognitive state, ask him questions related to his perceived, you know, swallowing difficulty, cough frequency prior to these events. I don't think at this point it would change management too much, but me in my kind of outpatient lens of things, I do see it being important because if we're expecting, you know, recovery of this acute incident over the next, you know, couple weeks or months, and our reliance and understanding of sensory deficits, is it related to this, then that might affect when I'm going to do a next instrumental assessment, right? Like if I'm expecting there to be a relatively quick change in his function, quick in an outpatient perspective, over the course of a month or so, I might recommend an instrumental assessment earlier rather than later. Because we might start to make different decisions in terms of his care. So I could see it down the road being more important, trying to figure out, you know, what's from this incident versus his Parkinson's diagnosis. But I think at this point, it would be impossible to know, and I'm not sure it would affect management that much.
Okay, good. Thank you. So based on these findings, what would you recommend regarding nutrition, hydration, and medication intake? Can you give a recommendation now, or are there still information missing?
I think some information that's missing would be the effectiveness of compensatory strategies that hopefully were trialed during the FEES exam. And so it sounds like he's going to be, you know, partial PO and still relying on the NG tube. I don't know exactly what types of medications he's taking and if they can come, you know, crushed or what their forms are. But it does sound like it's going to be kind of a somewhat of a trajectory to being kind of completely PO. So in terms of nutrition and hydration, I would have loved to have tested probably positional and postural strategies first, as opposed to just dietary strategies. But again, that's going to be reliant on his cognitive state and his ability to consistently and accurately do the positional and postural strategies. It may be, given the acute nature, some sort of dietary change, at least for the short term, and then making those changes very clear when kind of handing the patient off to the outpatient SLP, that these recommendations are recent and, you know, continued evaluation of the necessity of them.
Any other thoughts?
Well, I think at least for that acute setting, I would definitely find some alternatives for oral medication because, without having such an unstable general condition, this is something that is quite risky for Parkinson's patients. So I would try, just for that situation, would try to find an alternative for that. Mm-hmm. And go to an assessment whether he can manage medication orally. I would do that later. If I have no need to do that, I wouldn't put him at that risk, particularly not because, well, he is such a bad cougher.
Yeah.
So I think that maybe could be a good idea for that patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And so now we're diving to the treatment part. Which rehabilitative or compensatory strategies would you recommend? So Tom is now awake, alert, and following all your instructions, a dream patient. What would you do with him?
Well, he's just a perfect patient, as you tell me. Is he oralized now? So
no.
It depends, did you oralize him?
He's fallen on a nasogastric tube. Yeah. Or, mm-hmm. Okay, so given this is an acute setting, and well, maybe it's an acute setting in Germany, I wouldn't have much time for him and would like to transfer him directly to James. So nevertheless, I would implement some dysphagia strategies. And well, as you said, I would try to find some compensatory strategies that he can really, really do and that he can swallow safely with, because of course I want to have as much oral nutrition as possible, as early as possible. So I would begin to develop strategies with him, and depending on what his really problem is, that might be strategies that prevent really his aspiration in terms of that he has, well, swallows with a breath hold maneuver, for example, or that he has, well, begins to learn strategies to just re-coordinate his respiratory swallowing function, as well you described in your publications. I would try to begin with these strategies, having in mind that maybe he will need that in his further rehabilitation, because while we are talking about a patient with a progressive disorder, and I think he should learn such strategies early on. And also I would begin to, well, look for options for his outpatient situation, that he gets integrated into a structured monitoring program for patients with Parkinson's disease, and many acute care hospitals offer that the patients come back every 6 months or every year, or, well, given their situation, that should be initiated very early for him. And also, because you said that he has a kind of routine that he does 30 minutes exercises each day, I would try to develop with him a routine that he integrates oral motor exercises and respiratory exercises into that 30 minutes routine, and communicate with James as the outpatient therapist what I've agreed with him. And well, given that his respiratory situation is already bad, maybe that brought him into that situation, I would begin to, well, provide him with respiratory trainers to just stabilize his lung volume, his cuff strength. maybe EMST, something like that, because we know that is very efficient in that patient group. and, well, give all this information to the outpatient therapist.
So just to clarify, is he still on the NG tube when he's being transferred?
Well, of course, I would try to oralize him as much as possible. But, well, given the acute situation, at least in Germany, I would only have a few days. So I don't think it's realistic that I have him fully orally fed or I have him off the nasogastric tube at that time. But you can choose whether I have reached that effort.
No, I mean,
have
I think
been
that's,
successful in
that was
removing.
Good.
I don't know.
And I
you
think
can
that
choose how you want to have him because he's the ideal patient.
But I think the communication that you and I are having is really important. And I think that's something that kind of lacks a lot in clinical practice is the communication between, you know, the care teams on both the inpatient and the outpatient settings. And so I think it would be probably fine to leave the NG tube in as long as there's nice communication, like, you know, we are really trying to kind of get this removed. You know, his status is currently pretty questionable in terms of removal of it or not. He might be fine, but, you know, the patient and the care team might feel better to kind of hold off on a week if you can do a reassessment on the outpatient side of things. And I think that's fine as having the discussion with the patient since certainly he's aware at this point, and discussion with the hopefully multidisciplinary team to kind of figure out, we don't know what the right answer is necessarily, but what seems to be the best option that most people are kind of on board for. So I think it'd be fine to keep the NG tube in, personally. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, now, unfortunately, it's the case that...
okay.
I'm very sorry. But Tom is doing well in all aspects, but unfortunately not in his swallowing abilities. So he stays... he keeps not doing very well with swallowing, with eating and drinking. So the NG tube is staying. And his physician is also... bringing a PAC tube into the whole story. So now Tom is talking to you, asking for your opinion on that after
3 weeks by now.
3 weeks. See, he has not been transferred to outpatient yet. The physician wants to get this before sending him out. And the rationale for the PAC tube is because they're thinking a longer trajectory of swallow recovery. I think if Tom was asking us for our opinion, I would educate him on what the role of the PEG is and the expected trajectory and what's known about how it might or might not help, and that we don't have a crystal ball to know what is necessarily the best option. And I would ensure him that it's certainly our goal is to get him, you know, fully PO, certainly given how, well, regardless, fully PO, but certainly we understand that eating and drinking is very important to him, but that we're just kind of expecting a slightly longer kind of timeline, and, you know, NG tubes are not the most comfortable and typically are removed after, you know, 6 weeks or so. So doesn't mean that it's going to be in there for a year or two. It could be, but we're just thinking it's going to be a little longer than we expected, and having that conversation with the patient. So, yeah.
Well, given that I was a bit successful in my inpatient treatment and have, we have reached some point where he can just eat and drink small amounts of his favorite food, I would just like to give him the perspective that he can continue with that in the outpatient situation, and that he can, I think, particularly with these chronic patients, it's always good to, well, set goals so that you really definitely define, okay, what do you want to eat in 1 week, or what do you want to eat in 2 weeks, and set realistic goals, and maybe connect that that PEG tube necessity for a PEG tube to these goals. So saying, okay, let's say this PEG tube will give you the opportunity to really work on your goals. You don't have the nasogastric tube in there. Nobody sees that you're still on the tube, so you can hide it if you don't want people to see it when you're going shopping or whatever, but really focus the patient not on the necessity of the enteral nutrition, but on well, what he can reach in terms of oral nutrition. And, I think this is not only saying very easily, but I think especially to set these goals from an inpatient perspective, it's very, very important to communicate with the colleague who's working in the outpatient setting, because you can only set realistic goals when you know where the patient is going and what the colleague is going, well, what is the possibility of you to work with him and what is really realistic to reach, because you don't want the patient to be as disappointed, of course.
Yeah, and I think the thing to add to that is the types of conversations I'd be having with Tom, if I was seeing him outpatient, would be very different than if it was regarding this PEG conversation. If it was inpatient before the decision is being made, you know, as a clinician, I think something to be cognizant of is what is a PEG necessarily helping with, and that varies in patient populations, right? So we know that in certain patient populations, like more end of life, dementia, that it's not going to be reducing things like pneumonia rates and whatnot. But certainly in other patient populations, like head and neck cancer, it gets people through a 1 to 2 year period, and it's not necessarily something that isn't helpful. So I think in the speech pathology world, we are realizing that PEG isn't a cure for preventing aspiration, but I think it also is very dependent on the patient population. And so if the physician who was recommending it to Tom, having that conversation with Tom, was thinking this PEG is going to be helpful because he's got Parkinson's disease and he wants to live for, you know, the next 10 years or something, that is maybe not the approach I would necessarily go. So I think it depends on the patient that we're working with, the trajectory of that. If it is just like a 3 to 6 to 12 month, you know, pathway that we're thinking about, it might be appropriate. But I think if it's end of life dementia related, it might not be, and I'd probably be voicing that. I would be voicing that to the physician and the rest of the care team. But yeah.
Yeah, many interesting points that you were addressing. So Tom now decides to get the PEG tube, and he leaves the hospital. He's doing fine, and now he is going to your outpatient clinic. What would you do with him? What would be part of your treatment plan?
Yeah, maybe it's like my OCD nature. I like to kind of start from scratch a little bit, kind of have a clean slate with things, and kind of see where we're at with everything. I would be starting off with certainly a clinical swallowing evaluation. And I'd be doing the clinical swelling evaluation for a few different reasons. One is I'd want to be getting a sense of certainly risk for other dysphagia medical morbidities. He had a pneumonia in the past. Does he seem like he is, from a medical kind of general perspective, susceptible for things like malnutrition, dehydration, another pneumonia? So kind of getting an idea of kind of a risk factors for dysphagia-related medical morbidities. I'd also be doing the clinical swelling evaluation to try to get a sense of the potential pathogenesis of his dysphagia, if it's present, which I'm sure it is still. So, and what I mean by that is the dysphagia that he has, is it related to impairments in, let's say, muscle strength? Is it impairments related to motor control? Is it impairments related to, you know, somatosensory sensation or peripheral level sensation? And so I feel like that's actually not something that you necessarily get from instrumental assessments. It's what you get from the clinical evaluation. And so I'd be doing tests to try to make an educated hypothesis, because we never know for sure. And so I'd be kind of doing that from the clinical evaluation perspective, as well as building rapport and really getting a sense of what his goals are. So that's where I would start. In terms of the specifics of the clinical evaluation, things I'm going to be looking out for are things like his ambulation status, which is a risk factor for dysphagia, and his overall general health and certainly respiratory health as well. What is his oral care status? Certainly oral care is a predictor for pneumonia. We already kind of know that his cough effectiveness at least doesn't sound that strong. Whether or not there was objective testing, I'm unsure. But certainly that is another risk factor for developing a pneumonia, and kind of understanding when he hopefully starts to proceed with more oral intake, that's going to affect our management, knowing how effective his airway protection is. When I'm thinking about the clinical evaluation as well, I'm listening for things like his motor speech. I'm listening for like the patterns of his cough, the you know typical cranial nerve exam to, again, try to get an idea of, is he variable, right? That's something else, more Parkinson's disease versus, you know, the things in his history that I'm thinking about. He's got Parkinson's disease, so your brain starts to go to motor control, right? But he was, you know, inpatient. We mentioned cachexia, muscle loss, muscle wasting, essentially. So there probably is some underlying impairment with motor strength as well. His sensation is variable, but we were hearing lots of good things, right? We heard at the inpatient side that he was coughing at bedside. We saw that he was coughing, maybe not on every trial, but on many trials during the FEES exam. So when I hear that, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing, right? That he's got that sensation. So it seems as though his pathogenesis of dysphagia is probably related to both motor control and strength. The question is, what's kind of the heavier hitter? What's kind of the primary contributor to this? So that's kind of where I would start off with things.
Yeah, no, excellent. So many great points. And especially that you brought up the question about motor control and then strength. And in this case, it's really difficult to decide, I think. Mm-hmm. So, and that's your expertise as well. So any thoughts on this? Anything to add? You're just nodding for everyone who can't see it.
Yeah, I can just kind of add because it was so good. Yeah, I think that's just the point. You should find out. Mm-hmm. Because you have to have a notion what kind of strategy and treatment strategy would be beneficial for him. Mm-hmm. Is it a matter of strength or is it a matter of skill? Definitely, yes.
And I think from the outpatient perspective, it's when I think about the clinical evaluation, it's very different than how it would, the purpose of it. While the tasks themselves may be very similar, the purpose of it I feel like is very different than maybe inpatient, where you're thinking more specifically about aspiration risk and dysphagia risk. In the outpatient side, I'm really trying to leverage developing the hypothesis of what is the underlying cause, and I bring this up because that influences the type of exercises that I'm doing and how I'm structuring the exercises, right? So if I think he has impairments more in motor control, I'm probably going to be doing more skill-based exercises. If I think it's primarily muscle strength, I'm going to be probably focusing more on resistance-based exercises. So it's going to be affecting my management plan, which is why I care. It's not just intellectually curious what's the pathogenesis. It's because it's going to be affecting the management. I might be doing a couple of oral trials as part of the clinical evaluation, in part to, at least perceptually, I might be wrong because it's perceptual, but get a sense of his respiratory swallow coordination given the respiratory history that we were seeing, and certainly some muscle strength testing as well. So certainly things like IOP, respiratory strength, inspiratory and expiratory pressures. Yeah, because again, that's going to be influencing, again, potential exercises that I'll be recommending.
Great, yeah. Thank you so much. It's getting dark, kind of indicating that it's been a long day. But thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like to add? Any thoughts that you want to share with the listeners? Any final thoughts?
Indicate that I would definitely still be doing instrumental assessments as well. I wouldn't keep it at the clinical evaluation. So I know that this is just kind of for time's sake now that we're wrapping up. But certainly I'd proceed with instrumental assessments and then pair that with the clinical evaluation to determine therapy plan and work with the patient to figure out, you know, what his goals are, if he wants to undergo therapy. And that's going to be influencing the types of things that we're recommending for them. So, and oral care. He's got secretions galore.
Definitely.
And has developed pneumonia. Yeah. So we'd be certainly working on oral care as well.
We shouldn't forget that.
Nope,
thank you
nope,
for
nope.
putting that in.
Yes.
Really. Well, I think
Well, you didn't make it easy for us because there was just all these pieces of the puzzle that came into the picture. But I think, well, now after having these pieces, and I realized that this is not an easy case. And mm-hmm. well, our patients are also not easy cases. We don't get a textbook patient every day. So I think, and this is good that, well, we had to just connect everything because that's what we do in daily practice. So I think you shouldn't expect to see a patient once and have the full picture, but it takes you days and days and many, many steps and many obstacles until you have, and well, we still don't have the full mm-hmm. picture, but I think that reflects very well how we work in clinical practice. So thank you for challenging us so much. And I think that, yes, what is an interesting case. Yes,
thank you for accepting the challenge.
Thank you so much, Ulrike and James, for taking the time here during the ESSD Congress to discuss this case scenario with us. We hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. As always, you can follow us on Instagram at Dysphagia Matters, on Twitter at Dysphagia PCast, or on our website, dysphagiamatters.org. Thank you and take care. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.